We ready. Let's call the House Judiciary Committee to order at 8 minutes after 5 on May 6, 2001. For the record, present are representatives Meyer, Coghill, Roquefort, James, and Ogun. We have a quorum to do business. On today's calendar, our Senate Bill 176, distributorships, we're waiting for the committee substitute from Labor and Commerce, who made 16 amendments on that bill yesterday. They did all the heavy lifting, so we shouldn't have to worry about it. Representative Meyer and I participated in that little chore as we were waiting for the Senate to come out from underneath their rock. And we also have on today's calendar Senate Bill 161, Timely Judicial Decision, Judges Pay. And we'll take up Senate Bill 161. And hopefully the committee substitute will show up for the other bill in a timely manner. With that, we'd ask that Senator Donnelly join us, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate Bill 161. Updates or just some little bit of clarification in our existing law that requires judges to provide a salary warrant that they haven't had any decisions pending for more than 6 months. Makes it a little clearer now what isn't. Also sets out state policy in Section 1 that we see. The majority of cases decided within 6 months and appellate cases within 6 months of oral argument. Additionally, provide the voter's guide that information would be included in the voter's guide regarding if any judicial officer that was up for retention had failed to be issued their salary. Didn't make the 6 month rule, so the voters would have that information. And provides an annual report to the legislature of how many cases have been pending more than the periods of time that are set out in the policy, and that and some additional information about the types of cases that are taking longer than the target dates or times. And there's a page missing of mine, but I do believe that the next page that would be here, if it was here, clarifies that the that the information regarding salary warrants of the judges is public information, because in the past there was some difficulty with the Department of Administration refusing to provide that information to the Judicial Council. As you know, the Judicial Council is charged with ranking the judges and reviewing what kind of job they're doing, and without being able to get the information about whether they were doing their timely decisions, it was difficult for the Judicial Council to make that full analysis. So we've worked extensively with the court system, and there's a representative of the court system here today that could provide their point of view.
Is that concluded your testimony, Senator?
Yes, sir.
Questions of Senator Donnelly. Mr. Falcone.
Just a question as to the timeliness of this and the effective date, 2004. Could you explain to me the rationale for that?
Actually, I think the effective date was a holdover from when we had a more stringent bill. The original draft had stricter guidelines for appellate courts that are no longer in this version, and I think that's why the late effective date was in there, to give the court more time to gear up and to try to clear off their docket so they would be immediately faced with that problem. So I don't know how Mr. Christensen would feel about that now, but I think that was the main reason we had that delayed effective date before, so it may not be necessary now.
Okay, well, I'll keep that in mind. Thank you.
Representative James.
Well, my question is, explain to me a little bit more just exactly what this withholding of salary of justices, judges, and magistrates. Actually, tell me what happens if the 6 months goes by and they haven't done whatever it is, then what happens to them? What do they get? Their part of their salary? None of their salary? No advance in salary? What is it? I don't understand it exactly.
Mr. Chairman,
turn down.
Mr. Chairman, that is existing law has been in place since statehood. That judges are required to get their paychecks to sign an affidavit that says they have no matter before them for more than 6 months, pending before them. And that's exactly what happens. I mean, they don't get paid. They can't sign that affidavit, they don't get paid. And that's been in place since we've been a state. And what this does is does a little fine-tuning of the descriptive words of it, but it doesn't change that basic system.
So a lot of them have not been getting paid? If I might follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Right.
Oh, most of them have been getting paid because most of them have been able to sign their affidavits and have completed their work. There have been a few. There are instances where judges don't get paid and they have to deal with a backlog. We've been told about some judges who tend to wait until they got a problem and then they catch up with their decisions and then they get their paychecks.
Then they catch up their pay.
Yeah.
So it's just a delay. It's not taking it away from them. It's just
right.
A delay.
Oh, no. They don't lose that money. I mean, once they catch up, they get paid for all their back pay. Yeah, as soon as they can sign those affidavits. But like I said, that's the existing law.
Representative.
Well, and so let me understand then correctly. What we're doing is making this be publicly recorded on their in the election bullet that say whether they've done that or not.
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. First of all, we for the first time adopt a state policy or intent that's consistent with the goals of the court system. Also, as far as the times. We specify that information, if judge hasn't been able to fill out those affidavits, it has violated that time period, that information would be put before the voters in the voter's guide. And obviously, the judge has an opportunity to respond to that, too, in the voter's guide. We specifically make it public information, so there's no problem with that information getting to the public and to the judicial council from the Department of Administration. And we also provide that the court system would provide us with the legislature with information about the timeliness of decisions going on. And then we do that additional fine-tuning of the existing law regarding the 6 months.
One more follow-up question, Mr. Chairman, if I may.
Please.
And that has to do, almost slipped my mind where I was. It has to do with, has there ever been any studies done as to what the cost to the folks who are in court have with the extension of the time that the judges take to get a decision? Has there been any? It seems to me like it could be very expensive for some folks not getting a decision, which no matter which way it goes.
Mr. Chairman, most of the decisions before the appellate courts have been accomplished in under a year. I think Mr. Christensen knows the exact number. I think there's some 20 cases currently before our Supreme Court that have been there for more than a year. There's a few cases that have been there for more than 2 years, and there's one case that's been there for more than 3 years. And when I say 3 years, I mean 3 years since the final pleading was accomplished. I mean, they actually had oral argument. Since everything else was done, nothing more for the parties to do. It's been over 3 years since they decided it. I think the court recognizes that's too long. They're trying to live within the one-year guideline that this policy actually adopts, and the Chief Justice does not disagree with this as the correct policy of trying to get these decisions done within a year.
Senator Donnelly, could you point out in the bill where the 1 year for the Supreme Court is, or is it at all appellate levels? Or?
Page one, Mr. Chairman, intent, line 13. That virtually all appellate cases be decided within 1 year following the oral argument of the case, or if there is no oral argument, within 1 year following the date the case is taken under advisement.
Is it reflected in the statute? You have a six-month requirement. Does that apply to the Supreme Court?
Here's the problem, Mr. Chairman. The original bill did include a one-year provision for appellate courts, and if they didn't get it done in 1 year, that they would be subject to the same salary warrant provisions. The court strongly objected to that. The court said it was unfair to hold individual justices responsible for the collective inability of the court, the appellate courts, to reach a final decision. Since the final decisions, since one justice could have fully completed their duties, but if the other justices hadn't made up their minds, then you'd be penalizing the judge that had done the work or the justice that had done the work, and that wasn't fair. Additionally, the court said that the position of the court administration, now this isn't the position of the Supreme Court, it's the position of the administration of the court system, was that legislative mandates as far as judicial time decision periods are unconstitutional. And while they recognize that the 6 month has worked well and they don't oppose it being in statute, they believe it's unconstitutional, even though we've had since statehood and it's been working. But they do believe that expanding it to include appellate courts would foster litigation that would, in their opinion, likely lead to a decision that the limitation on the requirement of a time decision on the appellate courts was unconstitutional, and that might cost us the existing law also. And they've cited a couple examples in other states where other courts have ruled that. So in deference to that opinion, working in cooperation with the court system, we deleted that requirement, instead inserted the policy guidelines and the reporting, which the court system does not approve.
So in essence, the committee substitute reflects really a reaffirmation of the existing state statute and policy. It merely clarifies it in the relationship to the pamphlet and other reportage and procedural. Would that be a fair assessment?
That is a fair assessment, Mr. Chairman. It's consistent with existing policy. It's consistent with the policy guidelines that are being adopted by the Supreme Court. But for the first time, we do clearly make this public information, and we provide it in the voter's guide, and we have the information coming to us as a accountability check about how many decisions are going longer than 1 year.
And previously, was this information confidential or not available to the public?
The Judicial Council, several years ago, requested the Department of Administration to provide them with information regarding judicial warrants, and the Department of Administration refused to provide it.
Yeah, I read this morning on floor the letters from Mr. Cotton to at least two commissioners of administration in the last few years requesting that information.
Correct. So this just makes it really clear that that information is available.
Any further questions of the sponsor? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Christensen, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Chris Christensen. I'm the Deputy Administrative Director of the Alaska Court System. As Senator Donnelly has noted, the purpose of this legislation is to encourage timeliness and eliminate unnecessary judicial delay in judicial decision-making. The Chief Justice and other members of the Supreme Court share Senator Donnelly's concern, and as many of you know, they have been taking major steps in the last 2 years to address timeliness issues. Last year, the Supreme Court adopted very detailed time standards for the trial courts. Time standard is a quantifiable goal for the delivery of court services to litigants. Different time standards are adopted for different kinds of cases. Our computer system is antiquated, but we hope to start issuing quarterly reports on the achievement of these time standards later this year. Last October, we used federal funds to train all judges on case management techniques. We have established a mentoring program so that judges who are particularly efficient can take new judges or less efficient judges under their wings and teach them their tricks of the trade. As the Chief Justice told you during her State of the Judiciary speech a few months ago, the Supreme Court is also committed to shortening time in appellate cases. About 2 weeks before this legislation was introduced, the court adopted time standards for appellate court cases and new procedures for flagging and monitoring cases so that cases that are being delayed don't languish. I would note that this is very unusual. While it is pretty common for Supreme Courts to adopt time standards for the trial courts, it's almost unheard of for a court outside to adopt it for itself. But our Supreme Court thinks this is important. Judicial timeliness is an important issue to everybody in this room. We've been actively taking steps to address it. We're going to continue. Now, while the court system did oppose the original version of Senate Bill 161, the bill's sponsor has done a great deal of work on it during the committee process. We're very appreciative of his interest in our concerns, and we do not oppose the bill in its current form. The bill makes a statement of legislative intent that we believe is a reasonable expression of the legislature's will. In fact, it is very, very similar to the standards which the Supreme Court has been adopting. It does provide for some extra reporting requirements on judicial timeliness, both for the benefits of the electorate and for the benefits of the legislature as it's working on the annual budget. The issue of the six-month rule has come up, and I could get into that a little bit more, Mr. Chairman, since it is something that's interesting. Now, as Senator Donnelly noted, the rule has been on the books since 1959. Before any judge or magistrate, we have 99 judges and magistrates, can get a paycheck every 2 weeks. They just sign a sworn affidavit that they have nothing before them that's ready for a decision to be made that has been languishing for more than 6 months. Because the Supreme Court and the Court of Appeals are committees, the rule applies to the member who is assigned the job of writing the majority opinion. That opinion has to be out in 6 months. However, the full opinion may not be released for some additional length of time because it's subject to negotiation and revision by the other majority members. After the majority opinion is finished, and only then can a dissent be written. And then typically once the dissent is written, the majority opinion is redrafted to answer the dissent. Right now we have about 20,000 state employees, and the 99 judicial officers are the only ones who have their paychecks withheld if they're behind on their work. Now, I wear two hats. I'm the deputy director, an administrator, and as an administrator, I like the six-month rule because it keeps the cases moving. As a lawyer, on the other hand, and the person who serves as a general counsel for the institution, I do believe that the existing six-month rule is unconstitutional and wouldn't survive a legal challenge. It's been followed for 40 years as a matter of comedy, comedy being respect for the reasonable wishes of a coordinate branch of government. The legislature is the funding authority. The legislature has expressed a desire that decisions be made within 6 months. The legislature has generally provided funding and resources adequate to get cases resolved within 6 months. And therefore, it would be unreasonable not to respect the legislature's wishes in this matter. Last fiscal year, we had about 150,000 new cases filed with the court system. During that fiscal year, courts disposed of 150,000 existing cases. That's a lot of cases. And during that year, there were, 25 occasions when a judge or magistrate could not execute the affidavit and had their paycheck withheld for some period of time until they could execute the affidavit. Now, 25 delays out of 150,000 cases under the performance measure that's been set by the legislature is really a pretty good record, but it's not perfect. And you might ask, why is the Supreme Court imposing new time standards and training judges to be more efficient? And pretty simply, the six-month rule applies to the period of time once a decision is ready to be made. There's a whole period of time in a case before a decision is ready to be made, when the lawyers are spinning their wheels, conducting discovery, having hearings, and we strongly believe that through better case management techniques and riding herd on the lawyers a little better, we can get that period of time down as well and reduce the whole length of time that a case takes from filing to disposition. Mr. Chairman, the basis for our view that the law wouldn't survive a legal challenge is what's happened in other states. There are about a half a dozen states or so that have a similar law to our six-month rule. It's been challenged three times in Wisconsin, Montana, and Nevada. Each time the law was thrown out for reasons which are directly applicable under the Alaska Constitution. First, our Constitution provides that a judge's compensation shall not be diminished during the term of office except by a general reduction applicable to all state employees. Now, Mr. Chairman, as you know, money has a time value, and if you withhold a judge's salary for a period of time, you have the effect of diminishing it. I think the record, which was set about 15 years ago by an Anchorage judge, she was carrying an active caseload of 800 cases, and she had one case that was delayed beyond 6 months. It was a divorce case involving a court employee, in fact, and she had her paycheck withheld for over 4 months. It's sort of difficult to argue that that didn't have the effect of diminishing her salary during the course of the year. Second, under our Constitution, the Supreme Court is charged with administering the judicial branch, not the legislature. The six-month rule is really sort of a form of micromanagement that goes to the very heart of the Supreme Court's authority to administer our branch. It applies to the work of every judge, every day, in every case. Mr. Chairman, there's also a whole line of cases from other states in which the legislature has set timelines for courts to carry, to conduct themselves, to conduct cases, but has not put the penalty of withholding paychecks. And that there's about a dozen of those cases, and almost unanimity, I think with one exception, those cases hold that legislatures can't set those timelines. There is a rule of constitutional law that one branch of government can't set a timeline for another branch to carry out a constitutional function. And hearing cases is a constitutional function of the courts. This rule is generally invoked to protect the executive or the legislature from court orders, but rules like this do cut both ways. Now, notwithstanding our belief that the current law is probably unconstitutional, you've never heard us come into the legislature and complain about it, and I would suspect that none of you have ever been approached by your local judge and heard complaints about it. We do hear grumbling from time to time in court administration. I know Mr. Snowden said he heard grumbling before I showed up, and our answer is always the same. If you don't like the law, file a lawsuit. But until you file a lawsuit and get it thrown out, then get your cases done and get your affidavit in if you want a paycheck. Our goal, I think, is to make sure that circumstances don't arise which would cause one of the 99 individual judicial officers to decide to file a lawsuit to throw out the six-month rule. In the states where it has been thrown out, the lawsuits have always been brought by individual judges who were unhappy that their check was withheld, never by the Supreme Court or by the court system as an institution. This bill in its current form eliminates all those things which we believe might have resulted in a legal challenge to the existing six-month rule. We've worked very closely with the sponsor to make sure that would happen. So I'm confident to say that in its current form, this bill would not run the risk of having someone challenge the six-month rule.
Mr. Chairman, unless they decided to do so on the basic constitutional issues, would that be?
Mr. Chairman, that's a good point. We. You know, they can do it if they want to, and I suspect most of them don't because they do believe they have adequate resources. I think there's a lot of peer pressure in the judiciary not to do something like this to get your work done because everyone else is getting their work done. Something we have to do, I would respectfully suggest, something you have to do as an institution is to, as you're considering legislation, and particularly as you're looking at our annual budget each year, to keep this sort of thing in mind. You know, judges need to do this within 6 months, but in order to do that, they need to have adequate resources to do it within 6 months. And in most parts of the state, they do. We do have a few hot spots, such as Bethel, for example, where the local judge is currently carrying a felony caseload, a Superior Court caseload, about twice the average for Superior Court judges around the state.
I know. You're singing in the choir here. I think this committee, Mr. Christensen, has been very accommodative of your branch government this year and what we've done. We even took it upon ourselves to write a letter to make sure you get some money for your case management computers.
We do appreciate that, Mr. Chairman. I noticed that the rest of the money we need to do a case management system is in the capital budget, and assuming it goes through and the governor signs it, hopefully we'll have a modern system up and running 2 years after this July, and we'll be able to give you more statistics than you ever thought you needed.
Professor Berkley.
Sure. The court system have the authority to impose its own sanctions for on its own membership?
Mr. Chairman, that's actually an interesting question. In one of the states that threw their version of the six-month rule out, I think it was Wisconsin, the Supreme Court, in its opinion, struck down the six-month rule, but it adopted a court rule that was very similar. I don't believe it withheld paychecks, but it required judges to get their cases done within the same length of time that the legislature had specified, and it I think it made it a violation of the Code of Judicial Ethics, so any delay in a paycheck would result in sort of an automatic complaint to the Judicial Conduct Commission, and a judge could be sanctioned through that body. The Supreme Court, under the Constitution, does have a good deal of authority to administer our branch, and so I think the answer is yes.
President James.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. On that point, I wish they'd do that. because just the language and what they're doing here doesn't necessarily, whether it's constitutional or not, doesn't seem proper to me. I think that we do have even labor laws that would be saying that this is not what you can do. But I agree that if they agree that this is when they should get it done, it seems to me like they ought to pull us out of the fire there and put something in a court rule or something, such as you suggested, so we don't have this. It has a different penalty, and I kind of like that one that you mentioned. I think that might be even more effective. Well, it probably won't be any more effective, but we pass this legislation and we allow them to put that in the election bulletin. I'm not really quite sure that that's... Would you comment on that? Because I'm not sure that is proper either.
Mr. Chairman, again, we would take no position on that. We do not oppose that. Right now, I can give anyone a list, if you'd like it, of the 25 times a judge had their paycheck withheld last year, who they were, and what the date was, and how long it was withheld. We have always made that a public record. As Senator Donnelly noted, Department of Administration, which is the entity that the affidavits go to and then issues a paycheck, withheld those for many years. While they were withholding it, we were actually making them available to Ledge Audit and any member of the public who asked for it with a public records request. And we only found out during one of our Senate Finance Subcommittee overviews a few years ago that the Judicial Council had been trying to get that from DOA and wasn't getting it. And at that point, we told DOA, hey, we've got it. Ask us.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman, just briefly, and that is that that would be really nice. I think the public, generally the public, needs to do this, and they probably don't ever see anything except within the election bulletin. So providing that flies, I'm willing to support that because I think it is an important thing people need to know.
Mr. Chairman,
Rosenberger,
go in the section. And I'd say this because you've been a champion of removing items from the election booklet, which you felt were inappropriate as a form of electioneering. I just wonder.
Yes, ma'am. What a man.
It was your bill we voted on the other day, wasn't it, where we took off the term limit pledges?
Oh, that one, yeah.
That small item?
Oh, yes, that's right.
That was a big item.
Well,
it was a committee bill.
Okay. Well, then I will, as part of the committee, take some pride in that thing. But it seems to me we're running afoul that same principle if we're requiring the courts, the court officers, to insert in the election pamphlet information about their salary warrants, aren't we?
Matter of fact, we could have that debate in terms of a power which resides in the legislature to establish our election statutes and how we conduct our elections. So I think that even strengthens the position rather than converse. I think it's a legitimate purpose that we could ask for that information to be published in election pamphlets.
Would we then, following that line of thinking, would we in this body require publication of any, for example, APOC violation or ethics charge in the legislature?
Ethics charge or ethics
an
conviction?
Ethics conviction?
Well, you might want to introduce the bill.
Just understanding the parameters of what the committee finds acceptable in the election pamphlet.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative James.
If I might, there's a total difference between putting it in the election pamphlet and putting it on the ballot. I think that's the other issue that we had was on the ballot. This one is in the election pamphlet so that people can be informed. I think it's a totally different issue.
Yeah, and I think the if you read the correspondence from the Judicial Council requesting the information, so they can have it within their own to be able to perform their job is quite legitimate. Without doubt. Mr. Chris.
Mr. Chairman, I would note that I believe Bill Cotton from the Judicial Council has said that he is going to be putting this on their website along with the other information. So, I mean, this is something that I think in the institution, in the judiciary, there is support to make this information public.
Well, just on that point about the election pamphlet, you know, the judicial officers are bound by some very strict ethical requirements about what they can and can't say in terms of their ability to election, to run elections.
there might be some very good reasons why a warrant, you know, someone got a warrant, wasn't issued a salary warrant, and would it be permissible, I guess, Mr. Christensen, for a judicial officer who is required to put this information in an election pamphlet to offer an explanation?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know the answer to that question.
Senator Donnelly, come up so we can hear you.
This doesn't require the judge to do it. The judicial council puts in has a statement that they do, and so it's the judicial council would put this in, and then the judge has their own statement. They get to put their own statement in, so they have the opportunity to respond if there was circumstances like this and explain why.
And Mr. Christian, do you know, or Senator Donnelly, if there is a charge made in public during the course of the retention election, does not the judge have the right to respond to that then under the statute?
Mr. Chairman, I think a judge has the right, once a campaign committee has formed, a judge has the right to raise money and respond.
So he can form his own campaign committee and do that.
I think the judge has the right to respond on their own. I think that's the trigger. Sure. When there's another committee against them, is the trigger when they can form a committee and raise money.
That's the trigger for the expenditure of money.
Right.
But I think there's probably a First Amendment right to.
Absolutely.
The judges, there are
right.
restrictions
I would think
in the
so,
code.
Yeah.
There is a very strict code of judicial ethics, and it does restrict a lot of what a judge is able to say about a case that's pending or impending in any court of the state. So if a judge has handled a case, for example, and there are charges made against him in that case, he can't publicly make certain comments while it's still pending in the Supreme Court. But I think that this is, you're probably not talking about the facts of a specific case here. You'd be talking about, well, I was in the hospital.
Right.
Or I have twice the caseload of any other judge in the state, as in Bethel, and I just couldn't get it done. I think probably a judge could say that in the pamphlet.
I agree with you. He would have a First Amendment right to defend his position and respond to it. if it was printed in the pamphlet that he did not receive his warrants on a certain number of times, I would certainly have the right to be able to respond to that.
Yes.
Which I think is a legitimate public interest. Yeah. And Mr. Christensen, a question. Is it because of the standing issues that this hasn't been challenged before? And only if you were a judicial officer, you couldn't challenge the constitutionality? Is that why there hasn't been a lawsuit here, or what? I mean, does it have to be a judge, you think?
Any one of the judges who would have standing to challenge it.
Right, but then would anybody else?
Probably the institution would have the standing to challenge it, simply because we administer the judiciary. Whether or not a member of the public would have the power, I really don't know. It's an interesting question.
That could explain why it hasn't been perhaps challenged previously.
Right. I would, Mr. Chairman, the only people who suffer any kind of financial hardship as a result of this are the 99 judicial officers. And they're the only people who'd be willing to spend the money to be relieved of the burden. And I think we're all very fortunate. None of them, you know, from 1959 on, no one who's been a judicial officer ever has. And I hope that continues.
Mr. Chairman, I'm being beckoned to our caucus, and I apologize, but thank you very much for taking this up. And just let you know that if there's, you know, I'd take advice from the court system as far as the effective date. I'm willing to have a modified effective date if it doesn't cause the court system particular hardship. Okay. Thank you.
Do you have a date?
It's got a big delay now.
It's got 2004.
It's got 2004.
We did that when we were still doing the cleanup.
Yeah, I was going to ask me.
Oh.
Would you? What I don't like it.
2 years?
I don't want to.
What's the burn rate there? What's the burn rate on your case backlog, Ms. Christensen?
Well, there's nothing mandatory about the case backlog in this. It's just it's a policy that I think is consistent with the existing policy that Justice trying to
Should this be in effect for the next election, basically? That's the issue, isn't it?
Well, I think since it's now more advisory than mandatory, it'd be fine to do it beginning of next year, maybe?
I don't think we'd have a problem.
Okay.
2002. Well, therefore, it would be applicable. The pamphlet and other election requirements would be in effect for the next election.
Right.
Then.
Yeah.
Move that amendment.
And I'd object.
Well, what would be the, what's the exact, Representative James?
It would be on page 6, line 11, January 1, 2002. So that got the right way, but I got the right.
Yeah, you said it way out.
Yeah.
I remember when we were. Yeah, that was because you didn't want to.
It's not the same.
No, the 50 has a problem with.
Yeah, that's right. I did
that. You're in conflict with the cases that you're trying to catch up.
Senator Diamond.
I don't have any objection to January 1, 2002. That was actually a vestige of an earlier.
Understand. Ms. Christensen, you want to comment on
that? Mr. Chairman, I wouldn't have any objection to that effective date.
I maintain my objection.
There's an objection to amendment, conceptual amendment number one, to change the effective date. Could the Secretary read the roll?
Mr. Chair?
Excuse me, Representative Meyer.
If I may ask the Minority Leader, why do you object?
You know, we went through a long discussion yesterday in regards to another bill about separation of power and the propriety of one branch respecting another branch. And I think if we're going to compel another branch of government to do anything, we at least ought to give them some time to do so. In fact, you know, my opposition to the bill isn't based on the subject matter of the bill. It's based on my respect for the separation of powers. I just don't think the legislature should tell the judiciary to do something that the judiciary has the ability to do on its own.
Mr. Chair, but the administration saying that they're okay with this date. I mean, if they were opposing that, I would agree with your argument.
And I don't always agree with the administration.
Okay.
Well,
it's not the administration, it's courts. Just pointing that out.
Quite frankly, Mr. Chairman, if I might, it's another example of Representative Berkowitz carrying another issue to this issue.
And it's a bad thing to be consistent?
No.
I don't think it's consistent.
Let the record show that Representative Kukesh and Berkowitz did join us some time ago. I apologize to you gentlemen not pointing that out. But is there any further discussion of conceptual amendment number one? I'll just comment that I think that if this bill merits consideration by the legislature, that it should be enforced for the next election, because that's what the impact is. And I think that we have the constitutional right and responsibility as legislature to develop and promulgate our election laws here. And I think that's what, in large part, this bill does. Any further discussion on the amendment? Will the Secretary read the roll, please?
Representative Ogun is absent. Representative Coghill?
Yes.
Representative Meyer?
Yes.
Representative Berkowitz?
No.
Representative Kukesh?
No.
Representative James?
Yes.
Representative Roper?
Yes.
With that,
conceptual amendment number one is adopted. Very good. Any further questions? Mr. Christensen, the sponsor. Any further discussion on the bill?
Mr. Chairman?
Representative James.
I would move Senate Bill 176 out of its committee.
No, 161.
Right, 161. I'm looking at the wrong one here. 161 out of the committee with individual recommendations and.
Zero.
As amended.
As amended.
Are there any objections to
moving? I object, and with the certainty of irritating the Majority Leader again, I'm going to indicate that I think that we are violating the separation of powers by compelling the judiciary to do something they have the ability to do. And if someone could explain to me why this action is not a violation of separation of powers, I'd be interested in hearing that explanation.
Well, Representative Berkowitz, I contend that the administration of the elections is in the purview of the legislature, and that's the primary reason. And I think that the public has a right to know this information.
And I don't dispute that, Mr. Chair. What I'm disputing is that the legislature is compelling not only information about elections, but they're compelling the court system and the judicial officers themselves to file affidavits. I think it's inappropriate. It's an inappropriate intrusion of the legislature on matters that should be left internal to the judiciary.
Any further discussion? Representative James?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, that's an existing law. It's been here since statehood, and I don't think we should be discussing that portion of it.
And if I could, Mr. Chair, but there was indication that it is unconstitutional. And it's only for the sake of comity, C-O-M-I-T-Y,
that the courts have not pursued an objection.
And also their own internal administration, seeing the wisdom of the rule.
Well, that's the comity.
Call for the question.
The Secretary read the roll, please.
Representative Coghill.
Yes.
Representative Meyer.
Yes.
Representative Berkowitz.
No.
Representative Kukesh.
No.
Representative James.
Yes.
Representative Ogun is absent. Representative Roper.
Yes.
4-2.
Bill's moved out of committee 4-2. Thank you very much,
Chairman. Chairman, members of the committee, appreciate your time.
Next, I'd like to take up Senate Bill 176. We do have the CSJ version in front of us. Just received that. And Representative Myers and I were in the yesterday making certain amendments down in the Labor and Commerce Committee. Well, we counted all the senators done. We can say derogatory things. No. Anyway, we're taking care of some of the dark side's lack of work. But with that, we'd like to have the Mr. John Haxby come forward and has been crusading for this bill down here, and tell us what's in this legislation, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee as well for meeting. I've just gotten a copy of the CS as well and had a chance to briefly review it. My name's John Haxby, and I represent Waukesha Alaska Corporation. We are located in Anchorage, Alaska. Our company will be 30 years old next year, and it was started by my father in 1972. I've been operating the business in Alaska since 1984. We have approximately 13 employees, and our main business involves the sale and distribution of machinery as well as services throughout Alaska. Over the last 30 years, we've been in relationships with manufacturers. Relationships change over time, and there are occasions where distributor agreements are yanked without warning. In many cases, this can cause irreparable harm financially. Alaskan small businesses see immediate losses in jobs, and in our case, it has resulted in some $300,000 in unsold inventory, which remains on our shelf. Basically, what Senate Bill 176 does, and I'm not sure if I'm referring to it properly, maybe it's the committee substitute that was worked out in Labor and Commerce yesterday. Basically, what that does is that it levels the legal playing field in Alaska. Legal challenges are extraordinarily expensive, and in most cases, deep-pocketed outside manufacturers simply run you out of money. Cases like this can and have easily run into hundreds of thousands of dollars, and in one notable instance, from a person who will, in fact, testify today, legal bills have exceeded $1 million in climbing, even in a case in which the local Alaskan company has won in every court. It's not the Ninth Circuit. And in that particular case, there are continuing appeals that go on. This bill also keeps manufacturers from forcing unwanted or unordered inventory on Alaskan businesses. It's not uncommon to be made part of quotas unknown to yourselves and being told that, hey, you're going to take this inventory because you're our distributor, and take it or we're going to terminate you or we're not going to have a relationship anymore. The bill also allows for the orderly disposition of inventory if a distributor agreement is, in fact, yanked. It returns precious capital for that inventory, which would be remaining at the time of the termination of a distributor agreement, to be returned. The inventory would go back to the manufacturer, and there would be a repurchase by the manufacturer of that inventory. This allows Alaskans to take that capital and reinvest it in business here in the state. The bill also allows that in the event of the death of a distributor or the death of a dealer, that an orderly and equitable return of inventory can be accomplished quickly. It's especially important in these cases to be able to have an orderly disposition of inventory and or the business, because many times the IRS comes in and they value the business according to the past performance of the business. In the event that a distributorship is in fact yanked, and the IRS has come in and said, we have a tax bill because your business is valued at X dollars, and they assess a tax value, In the event the distributorship agreement is yanked, the value of the business may in fact go to zero, and the liability, the tax liability, remains with the estate itself. So theoretically, it has the possibility to wipe out the heirs after the death of a dealer.
I know.
I read through this particular committee substitute, and I have pretty much agreed with the way that it is written at this time. And there are, with the exception back on page 6, I believe that it would be line 11, where it talks about distributor agreement means a written agreement. In the original language, it had given three other words in there which stated whether express, implied, oral. And I think it's important to note that that oral agreements are specifically, especially in Alaska, are relatively common. And I believe that there should be somebody who will testify today as well, where in one particular case, an oral agreement or an oral, that it was proven in the court or it was adjudicated by the court that in fact there was an oral contract that was there. And that relates to Alaska Rubber and Supply, and I believe that lady will testify today as well. And anyway, I'd like to ask for your support of this bill. I think that it's good for Alaskan businesses. I think it's good for Alaskan employees, and that it should treat everybody in Alaska similarly.
President Berkowitz.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I mean, I'm pretty close to wanting to move the bill if that's going to be the will of the committee. And I know that people might be waiting, but do we have anyone with legal expertise intending to testify on this?
No. There are two other witnesses that wanted to testify briefly. Any other questions? Representative James.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I understand the conflict between businesses, the big businesses and the little businesses, and the supplier and the person who is having this distributor's products on their shelves and in their place of business, and the problems with that. And I had a lot of experience with this. Wish this would have been laws on the books when I was a bankruptcy trustee for 10 years and had a lot of disposition of inventory that I had to do with. And also as an accountant and taking care of folks who do have that sort of thing, I have experienced where people have had a distributorship taken away from them, and it was disastrous in small engine issues, and that's what Waukesha is a lot, isn't it? Wisconsin, as an example, was one of the ones, and the other one was starts with a T, Tecumseh, one of my clients, and it was devastating to him, and eventually he did go bankrupt. So this is, I think, a really good idea to protect Alaska businesses. This is an Alaska law to protect Alaska businesses. If distributors want to send their merchandise to the state for us to be selling their merchandise, then I'm in favor of this. I have a little bit of a problem if we have an in-state distributor as to whether or not that is going to be a problem, and I would like to ask that question. If we have a big provider of here and they're distributing to us, little
we did in yesterday. If you look in the exemptions, we exempted like breweries with their wineries. Specifically, but sub 5 on page 6, under exemptions, I put in a manufacturer with 50 or fewer employees. The testimony was that many times manufacturers end up being distributors of their own.
Well, yeah, that's my point. Or we have an in-state manufacturer.
Well, I thought that there would be equal protection problems, so I put a manufacturer with 50 or fewer employees, which generally covers most manufacturers in the state of Alaska, unless it's a food processing, you know. Representative Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, if you recall, I think this was like one of the last amendments we dealt with after about 3 hours of cleaning, as Mr. Chairman said, cleaning up the Senate version.
I first offered 100 employees.
Yeah, we started out with 100 and kind of compromised at 50.
Because I didn't want to use in-state manufacturers because I thought there might be some equal protection problems there.
Well, and just one more thing, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to put on the record with Mike, because I've also worked for wholesalers, not in Alaska, but in, and I know that they do have to have some rules and regulations about who's out there, particularly if there's a problem with their product not being properly displayed and not properly managed, and not, they have a limited amount of the distributorships that they can have in a certain area, and they're kind of in trouble. I don't think that's going to affect us here in Alaska necessarily, and I don't think there is anything in here that would be Unfair Trade Practices Act at all. I think this is going to make it better instead of worse. So for all that, without reading it from one end to the other, I'll trust you that you did a good job in getting it done.
We do have two more witnesses that did want to sign to testify. Why don't we go off net and take the testimony of Janice Higgins, please? Ms. Higgins, are you available?
Yes, I am. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Good evening. My name is Janice Higgins, and I'm with Alaska Rubber Supply. I've told my story to several committees. I don't think that I need to go over all the details again, but there are some aspects of our case that I think are relevant to some of the changes that were made yesterday. We had a signed dealer agreement in place that fell out the criteria. Regional sales reps made oral changes to that agreement with regards to volume discounts. For 15 years, we followed the instructions of the sales reps, and every month, the paperwork was filed, accepted, and discounts were applied to our account. The parent company sold the manufacturing plant, and the variances were noticed. Because we had not followed the original signed document procedures, they demanded we repay all discounts, and when we refused, we were terminated as a dealer. Since the paperwork had been mailed, the distributor also charged the owners and previous general manager with RICO violations and criminal charges. These were very serious charges. We have prevailed at every level, and the ruling by the court provided that the oral changes made by the sales representatives and accepted for 15 years by the distributor, in fact, became the new dealer agreement. This case has been to the Ninth Circuit, and we have prevailed at that level as well. Oral agreements and oral changes to existing agreements happen every day in the business world, and I urge you to keep language in this bill to cover that issue. As a side note, we also have dealers set up throughout the state. We support them with inventory, training, and technical data. This bill will affect us from both sides of the distributor-dealer agreement, and we feel it is fair. Thank you for allowing me to testify.
Ms. Higgins, could you give a cite on the case at the Ninth Circuit?
I'm sorry?
The cite or the name of the case?
It would be Aeroquip versus Alaska Rubber and Supply, Don Adams et al.
What, Aeroquip?
Aeroquip. And it is...
Still being appealed. We're still in the process of trying to settle all of the final legalities. And John didn't mention that, but a specific number, but our legal bills have been $1.2 million. It started in 1995, and it's not over yet.
Who is
your, you can't, we can't talk to your attorney anyway. It was Aeroquip versus who now?
Alaska Rubber and Supply.
Mm-hmm.
And the partners were Don Adams, Drennan Adams, Tom Moore, and Alaska Interior Rubber. There was a sister store in Fairbanks that was also affected by this.
And you say it's still on appeal? Is it still before the Ninth Circuit?
The Ninth Circuit upheld the ruling of the lower courts. There was a dispute again from Aeroquip regarding some of the payments that they were going to have to make, and so that they threw it back to Judge Singleton. And he is still reviewing it. They missed the deadline, and they're appealing that. They think they should have time again to come back in.
So the Ninth Circuit remanded it to Judge Singleton?
Correct.
Okay.
And if you'd like, Webb Shea was our attorney, and I'm sure he would be available for any questions you have.
Okay. Any questions of Ms. Higgins? And did the Ninth Circuit, in your recollection, talk about the issue of oral contracts or the implied contracts?
That was the basis of the whole thing being upheld with power with us prevailing was the fact that, of course, their sales representatives denied ever saying that we could file these the paperwork in the manner that we had, but there was too much evidence of them accepting it for the 15 years. And there were four different sales representatives, one who was no longer with the company, that did in fact testify that, yes, that conversation had taken place. So that was the whole crux of us winning, was that the oral agreements that were stated and the sales representatives acting in on behalf of their company were in fact creating a new agreement.
Great, thank you. Any further questions on Ms. Higgins? Thank you very much, ma'am.
Thank you.
Deborah Looper. Deborah, are you there?
Yes, sir. Thank you for hearing this bill today. I appreciate it very much. My interest in this bill was when I first began talking with John Haxby, and I have some experience working with small business. I worked for the National Federation of Independent Business, and I used to go and visit with hundreds of business owners every year and listen to their concerns. This is an important concern. Many small businesses, one of their major complaints is that they do not have the time, the staff, or the resources to respond to legal challenges, whether somebody slips and falls on their sidewalk, or if and sues for damages, or if in fact on the other side, the big guys decide to yank a distributorship agreement or whatever, they just don't have the resources to respond. I want to mention that in talking to a number of business owners, what I discovered is that these, yanking of the distributorship agreement has nothing to do with performance in many, many cases. It has everything to do with developing new markets, or maybe new management comes in, or maybe a big distributor is trying to sign up somebody in Seattle, and the Seattle guy goes, well, I will take your product only if I get the OS to market as well, and before you know it, the Alaska business, who has trained employees and built infrastructure and has come, in fact, to depend on this product, the sales from the product is suddenly, with sometimes no notice in the next 30 days, it's gone. And they're left with inventory that here in the municipality of Anchorage, they continue to pay inventory tax on what becomes until at some point, maybe it might take a year or so before they can get that off their books. Sometimes they can't get it off at all. I'm also very concerned about what happens when the dealer dies and passes his estate on to his family. They're already dealing with a horrific loss, and then to get stuck with huge IRS bills that may actually leave them in the red with no business at all, even to pay that bill, is beyond contemplation. Anyway, I thank you for hearing this bill. I urge you to pass it, and thank you.
Thank you very much. With that, is there any questions, Ms. Looper? Thank you very much. We have received some suggestions for a couple of quick amendments. The first is, if you have, there was a paper that was issued here. Ms. Haxby, did you provide this?
No, I believe that...
Ms. Looper did?
I believe that...
Alaska Rubber, I think.
Alaska Rubber or Ms. Looper? I've not seen...
Well, these are issues we discussed yesterday at the Laborers' Commerce Committee. As a matter of fact, if we could take each of these, if you have these proposed amendments here, the first one should say page 3, line 22 instead of 16. The next one is page 3, line 26 instead of 20. The next one is page 6, line 11 instead of 2.
Would you give me that one more time? The
first one is page 3, 22. Second is page 3, 26. Page 6, 11.
Okay.
The first one, I like to move these as conceptual amendments one at a time. The first one is on page 3, line 22. Insert the words without cause following terminates a distributorship agreement. And I'd move conceptual amendment number 1. And I'll just discuss it. We talked about this yesterday, and I thought we had changed it, but what we were doing, this is the requirement, the distributor actually purchased the business if there's a termination. But it seems to me that, and this is whether it's willful or not, it's just any termination is would be a statutory mandate to terminate. But it seems to me that we have to have a without cause, a termination without cause. If there's a breach of contract on the part of the dealer, then the distributor shouldn't have to buy the business if the dealer didn't meet his bargain. Mr. Haxby, you got a question?
Mr. Chairman.
We did discuss this yesterday.
Mr. Chairman, I understand what you may be looking at there. However, without cause, when this had been discussed with legislative legal, that brought up whole new issues regarding what is cause. And that made it so very difficult to define. It ended up basically we had to define all of the different reasons for cause that there may be out there. And when we talked to legislative legal, I believe that our original bill had that in there, and then we just took it out because we couldn't go through and define all of the definitions.
Well, it does trouble me, and that's because if there's a contract right, if the dealer's screwing up and there's a termination because he's not performing, what's the distributor to do then? He has to buy him out?
Well, the value of the business would be decimated.
Saying the marketplace would... The crucible of the marketplace would take care of the valuation.
Yes, yes, sir, it would.
And that's why we did not, that's why the Labor and Commerce Committee deleted goodwill.
That's correct,
from
sir.
The definition.
That's Representative
Bergwith?
Mr. Chair, I do have a suggestion on this. We're trying to itemize what the harm is in sections 1 and 2. It would seem to me that what you ought to do is just make the distributor liable for damages incurred.
Well, I think that's a little bit difficult because of the nature of the inventory and the assets that are in the inventory.
Well, that's what, in addition to any purchase of merchandise required, so that's going to have to be done. If a distributor terminates a distributorship agreement or makes substantial changes, the distributor shall be liable for damages incurred instead of purchasing, mandating purchase.
Well, hopefully being more specific and avoid litigation, you don't have to go to court every time you have a termination.
It would seem to me that if you're heading that way as is, if the distributor chose to disregard any of these requirements, you're going to court.
Representative James.
Well, thank you. On this issue, and I certainly can support this purchasing back the inventory, and my experience in that is that leftover inventory is worth nothing. It's like 10 cents on a dollar is all I could ever get out of any inventory, because first of all, it's been picked over probably in the most... And most of it would be some things you don't use very often when you get down to that inventory.
But this goes beyond inventory.
Well, I know, but I'm talking about the inventory itself. I think it should be purchased. And what Representative Berkowitz, I think, is saying that unless there's another part in this that I'm missing in the bill where that is already a piece and doesn't need to be at the end here, I think I agree with his statement that we should have it be that they should pay the damages. However, I think they need to pay at least 85% of the cost of the inventory.
Well, you look back. There is
that in there in a different place?
Yes, it is.
Did I miss it?
Page 2, there's disposition of merchandise remaining upon contract termination.
Yeah, okay, that we want to keep in there then.
Right.
Okay, then
primary.
I'm willing to look at this other.
We have an inventory.
That's right.
Provision up here in page 2.
Okay, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. I haven't been chastised yesterday. under 45.45.7.10, there's the buyback provisions.
Right.
And what 45.45.7.40 does is specify other damages.
Right.
But when you itemize like this, like we're attempting to do, it also can have the effect of being exclusionary. And you might say assets, and you want to throw goodwill and machinery, and for
it's
other
not
expenses.
Damages per se, it's the evaluation of the business.
Yes. Well, but for example, there could be costs that have nothing to do with assets, goodwill, and machinery. It could be time, the time that individuals spent pursuing a case or pursuing this, which is why, I mean, we're throwing this open. We're making, in essence, we're trying to itemize the damages. Let's just say they're liable for damages. And
well, that's the other issue we have, because we have a without cause termination here, and so we wanted to narrow it.
But there's
Mr. Axby, do you want to have a comment?
Mr. Chairman, and Representative Berkowitz, I would suggest that change not necessarily be made. Typically, when you go into a business valuation, there are all kinds of things that are taken into account at that time. We eliminated goodwill yesterday, specifically because it was thought to be something that was not definable. And most of the time when you go in through a business valuation, they say they will look at growth rates, growth curves of the business. Is it gaining at 25% year over year? Then that may have a multiple of earnings for one business, where if it's in decline, then that would have a more limited valuation. So I think that rather than worrying about damages, which are tough to define, a methodology like this just allows us to go in and say, okay, here we get a commercially reasonable business valuation, which is available from many different sources, and say, that's what it is. Then we don't need to, this allows us to get it over with quickly as opposed to necessarily go through litigation to get it accomplished, unless you have a distributor who's against that.
Well, Mr. Chairman, goodwill is something that you can measure. People buy businesses, including goodwill.
I know.
And when they do, and people may buy a business that has a distributorship, and they've paid goodwill for that distributorship. They have a record of that, so I think it is something that you can recognize.
Oh, I agree. You can recognize it, but the question here is, the compromise that we worked on yesterday was the fact that you can terminate, if there's a terminate with or without cause, the statute would force the distributor to buy.
I understand that.
You can't do it without cause. I mean, every agreement is governed by the covenant of good faith and fair dealing.
Well, that's the issue. I think the privity contract has to be respected here. And I presumably, you know, lacking any other termination provisions in the contract, it would be the basis of any disposition.
So a distributor can't just willy-nilly cut somebody off without suffering consequences. They're breaking the implied covenant, which is part of every agreement. It's the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing. And when there's a breach of that implied covenant, then the question arises, what are the damages? And in essence, what this tries to do, and what troubles me a little bit, and I've got to go in just a moment, Mr. Chair, but what troubles me is most instances when we have disputes between parties, we let the parties hammer out the differences amongst themselves. We try not, through the legal system, mandate specific results for instances between types of parties. And here, in essence, we're having a contract. We're trying to deal with a contract dispute. And we ought to be real careful about prescribing a result for these particular sets of parties for more.
Well, I think we're trying to narrow the issues in debate, but they're still pretty broad.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman,
Representative
James. Yes, if I might, that Representative Berkowitz is saying, you know, that these things are illegal, and they have a case and all those kinds of things. But you're talking about a small business in Alaska with a huge distributorship outside.
Mm-hmm.
And this small business has no opportunity to go to court. But if he has something in there, if we have something in state law, they'll change their way that they do business with Alaska. That's where we're trying to get, so that we're not vulnerable to those folks. These little folks, they can't be spending time suing somebody that's outside the state. That's absurd.
I agree. That's why we want to put in here machinery and assets and the time of necessarily incurred expenses is what we have here. I mean, but you're right. I can't deny that this might lead to litigation, but the steamroller attorneys that cost like Alaska River to spend $1.2 million to just for legal fees.
It's unconscionable. It is very difficult. It is very difficult. Other states
we're trying to avoid litigation.
Laws. Other states have laws which are very similar to this.
And I just, you know, Representative James is going to chastise me for covering old ground, but you know, this is what tort reform was all about. This is, we took away some hammers from the small business person by saying we were going to limit punitive damages.
Well, let's get that sledge right back to him, then. That's what we're trying to do here.
Right.
Before you leave, I would like to take up this the implied and oral contract, because I see,
Chairman, I don't think anyone objected to your amendment, so I think we can go on.
No, we haven't offered. I'm withdrawing amendment number one.
Yeah. Okay.
So now we're to number two, the goodwill, or not?
Why don't we...
go down to the third one.
Let's go down to the third one right now.
Okay.
Before, Ethan, because you had a concern about this.
Right, I have an amendment to the amendment.
On the
you
third
haven't
one?
Offered yet.
Well, I'll move the inserting of an agreement, whether expressed, implied, oral, or written in there. On page 6, line 11, Representative Berkowitz.
There might be, I think what we should just say is a valid agreement instead of...
How about, or an enforceable contract or what?
Well, I don't know what the terminology is in the Uniform Commercial Code, but...
You got any ideas, Heather?
No, but she was the one who reminded me about the UCC.
Right. How about a conceptual amendment for the drafter to be consistent with a valid agreement that's enforceable under the UCC? How's that? We can live with that. Are oral agreements enforceable under the UCC?
Not necessarily.
It within parameters.
Well, I'm concerned about that, given the history of this case from Ms. Higgins and the testimony there.
In her case,
implied contract.
There's implied contract, there's detrimental reliance, and so... There is that.
But it's like they have some kind of a novation or addition to their contract because of the implied actions of the parties. And it's been a long time.
Yes. Mr. Chairman, we spent a lot of time on this yesterday, and we went back and forth. And I think, as you recall, I was on the opposite side as you with this, and we felt like written agreement was necessary because this is a good business practice, and if you're going to go into business with a large corporation or whoever, and you're going to sell their product, then you should put it in writing, especially if you have a large monetary investment.
Heard the witness tonight, and that this common business activity doesn't necessarily mean you have to go around and amend your contract every time you have a particular long-term relationship. It just doesn't happen sometimes. Not that you shouldn't, but it just doesn't happen.
It's good business practice, and I think, as Representative Murkowski mentioned, we're supposed to write this for futuristic events, and I think we want to have more people put their agreements in writing than to do them orally and by a handshake.
Just don't happen, though. Representative James.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, you wouldn't get one. That was it. You wouldn't get one.
That's
because
the trouble,
salesman
right?
has the right. He's on the grounds to make this agreement, has the rationale and whatever, and is authorized to do it in this particular case, and then he notifies that this has been changed and this is happening. If they had to go back to the place where they got the written and agreement, they'd never get one. So they would have never gotten the benefit in the first place, and that might have been a disadvantage to them on both the distributor and the dealer.
Albert, can you help us on this one?
Now that Ethan's gone, we can pass this thing
out. Well, we just want to do the right thing now. We're working with some a brilliant legal mind here, just to make sure we go in the right direction.
Nope, I didn't have any problem with your valid agreement enforceable under this UCC.
Mr. Chairman.
If that's the compromise, then.
That'd work.
How do we do that?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative,
with all due respect, we should study the UCC before we go down that road. And so my suggestion would be, let's go ahead and put the express, implied, oral.
Study the UCC?
Well, study how it would be applied. We don't want to.
In this particular instance.
Right. Because if we encode that at this point without looking into what the effect is, I don't think it would be wise.
Albert, help me out here.
I don't have any problem with an agreement, whether expressed, implied, oral, or written. I
think that's good.
I don't either.
With it, but
I don't either.
Oh, he's back. We should have voted earlier.
Yeah.
Well,
go yet?
No.
Did you bring information on the UCC?
No.
I think
UCC is.
Mr. Chairman, just to bring Mr. Berkowitz up.
I
just suggested if we're going to do language based on UCC, then we ought to get ourselves an address there that we're going to go look at to address something specifically. And otherwise, just go ahead and put the express, implied, oral, or written in there. And, you know, and if just so we can move this thing along, because that's the intent.
Right. We got to get this.
And then if somebody wants to go look into how the UCC deals with contracting on some of the oral agreements or what case law might have been on that, I mean, I'd be open to suggestion because I can't think of any better at being on the end of many oral agreement distributorships. In fact, I can remember one time throwing a snafu in there. We sent a lynx pelt in lieu of some bills based on an oral agreement and threw Union Oil Company into a tailspin for quite a while. They didn't know how to punch that into their computer.
Probably did it intentionally. Well, what's the will of the committee? I will move conceptual. Did I move conceptual yes. Amendment number two? We have it before us. I mean,
no, it's three.
I didn't move this. Did I move the Goodwill one?
No.
We numbered them 1, 2, 3.
Oh, I'm sorry.
On the bottom, so.
Okay, we're at this conceptual amendment number 3 then, out of order. Okay. Forgive me.
I object, Mr. Chairman.
You object. Further discussion. I think this is the.
I need a clarification. You moved it just as it's currently written, not as we discussed.
Yes.
Currently written.
Okay.
And there's objection discussion. I think this is the right way to go. I mean, I'd be willing to go to UCC language, which would tighten it up, but we'll listen to Representative Coghill, and then somebody can have the job to get it all straightened out by tomorrow.
Whoever made objection.
No.
Assuming that the amendment passes and we find that it crosswires with the controlling case law, would you help us repair the problem on the floor?
Sure, but I don't think it should. I wouldn't think so. The drafter drafted it to begin with.
Okay.
So I think if we go back to the drafter's language conceptually.
Because I don't want to.
It was in the bill. It came out. The bill we had yesterday from the Senate had this language in it.
Because, I mean, the danger is we get in a situation where we pass a law that's crosswise with different statutes and then wind up putting people who are trying to use the statutes in protracted litigation. And
no,
that's
this,
not to anybody's benefit.
Our drafter has already drafted the language in the bill, so we're just going back to that. And I think it's right. Representative Myers.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, I just think it's poor business practice to not do an agreement in writing. And I think no matter who you're working with, if you ask or insist that it be in writing, that they will accommodate. That is the standard practice in the business world. And again, if you have any financial investment in the business at all, you're going to want it in writing because it's going to make it that much easier if you have to prove your case in court. So that's my reason for objecting is I think we should not even imply that an oral agreement is acceptable.
That's because you work for a Fortune 500.
That's what I was
going
to say.
No, Mr. Chairman, that's
not
true.
I agree with you. You're absolutely right. I wouldn't dispute you at all management-wise, but we're talking about the real world and the legal implications.
I loaned my brother $5,000, and we put it in writing.
Good idea.
Exactly. And I would recommend
so
that.
When he gets divorced, he can get the money from his ex-wife. Yeah, right.
You haven't had any conversations with these slick salesmen, little businesses. Little businesses. Home
Question.
Further question. Secretary, read the roll.
Representative Meyer.
Nope.
Representative Berkowitz.
Yes.
Representative Kukesh.
Yes.
Representative James.
Yes.
Representative Ogun is absent. Representative Coghill.
Yes.
Representative Roepberg.
Yes. Conceptual amendment number 3 passes. Does anybody somebody want goodwill in there or not?
No.
I don't think that.
No. We won't offer.
It is measurable.
Right. Well, let's not, because it's the way the termination is, adding additional elements to be purchased, I think, is why we took it out yesterday. We should leave it out. With that, Chair, what's the will of the committee?
Mr. Chairman, I would move.
Representative James.
Senate Bill 176, J as amended, out with individual recommendations, and if there is a fiscal note, I don't need that.
Zero fiscal note. Are there any objections to moving as amended?
Well,
Seeing none. So ordered. And we just adopted one conceptual amendment number three, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, didn't we do one and three, yeah.
Okay. No, we didn't do one. We just did three.
One was wrong. We left that one out.
We didn't do that. Okay. We just did three.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, this committee is
adjourned
for this session.